Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
Welcome to the world. I hope everybody's having a great time. I'm your host, Rob Starr, and I'd like to welcome back someone who is my teammate, my peer, my hydraulic guru, a great friend, and best co-host I had. And we're bringing him back because he was in the grasp of the COVID for the last couple of weeks. So we're pleased to have, and I want to welcome back Mr. Chris Gates.
Awesome, Rob. Right back at you, man. I appreciate it. I can't tell you how happy and underlined relieved I am to be back behind the microphone here.
Yep, and you can talk, which I love.
Yep, I can say three words without getting into a coughing fit, so that's good.
Absolutely. So you sound fantastic. I know I've been communicating with you back and forth over the last couple of weeks, and I'm glad you're doing much well. I mean, for anybody who hasn't experienced it, we wish you don't ever have to do that. It's not a great thing, and Chris went through it and he roughed it through, and as you hear, he's coming out great, and we appreciate that, and glad to have him back. So, Chris, any words to anybody about keeping safe?
No, just thank you, Rob. I mean, it's certainly from my standpoint not recommended to get COVID. Right. It was not a fun ride, but I've recovered. I'm well. Knock on wood, or in my case, simulated wood grain formica. I'm back in the saddle.
Okay, good to know, and I'm sure our listeners are happy to hear your voice because they get tired of hearing mine for those hour shows. I'll tell you that. Anyway, we have coming up now somebody who people think is the she's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, which people refer to that as the Netflix for water issues. And I want to bring her on, Ms. Chris Austin. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? So glad to have you back, Chris.
Thank you so much, Chris.
So, Chris, what's happening in the world of California with this the snow stuff that's not happening?
Well, you know, we had a whole bunch of storms there for a while. The storm door opened, as they say, and prodigious amounts of precipitation fell over Northern California and some fair amount over Southern California, too. And it was all great, and, you know, everybody jumped for joy. And there was some flooding and there was some damage, it wasn't widespread. So, you know, it went a little over the threshold of we want, you know, to have as much precipitation as we can have without causing, you know, flooding or any damage, right? So it went a little over that. And so you would, you know, there are those that would like to think that we're in the clear now. But, you know, again, we're not really, because it's just the start, you know, doesn't make up for the very dry fall that we have just experienced. And it's different statewide as it has been in the past. Statewide, it's about 70% of average, but where they actually did the snow survey in the Sierras, which is, I think it's in between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe at a place called Phillips Station. It's on the Highway 50, if you're familiar with the area. There was 93% of average for this time of year at that point, but it's less in Southern California, and it's not uniform across the state. Statewide, it's all 70%. And this is important because really, the snowpack in the Sierras has been our largest reservoir. It's this natural thing. It piles up in the winter, and it melts slowly over the coming months, and that fills the rivers and the streams, and that's what fills our reservoirs. We built our system here in California for you know, that kind of a snowpack that persists, you know, by April 1st, it should be nice and healthy, and then it sort of peters down until about July when it's all sort of run out. But that's not what we're getting these days. And so it's, you know, right now we need a number, you know, a bunch more of those storms to come through, just a handful, two or three more maybe, and that would be great. But, you know, it's unlikely because it looks like we're going into another dry spell. So it's sort of turning everything on its head. Although the spring forecast seemed to think that winter in some areas was going to persist, they were talking more about the East and the Midwest, and they were saying that there may be, you know, winter may persist in that area. And you never know, maybe the jet stream moves and some of that might actually come over here. You never know. Just a handful of storms makes the difference between a good year and a bad year, and we will hope that there's more on the way.
Yeah. Well, they said they're still aiming for the 55 gallons per person per day. That's still the goal that they've set, and they're still going to march to that. That's your view as well, that's going to continue?
Well, I mean, you know, that was an interesting article that managed to take two completely unrelated things and put it into a headline. You know, that law was passed when Governor Jerry Brown was in office, and it has been, you know, they said this is our goal, and that piece of legislation set in a whole process that has been working for the last couple of years in a lot of work groups where they, you know, the State Water Board doesn't make their regulations, you know, in their offices and then hands them off. They take public input. And there have been a number of workshops and everything trying to figure out how to implement the legislation and getting input from the people who are going to be affected by it and trying to figure out how to come up with something that is workable. So, yeah, the state's still on track because they're meant to be, you know, it's the State Water Board that's putting together these regulations. And, you know, the goal is you're not going to get fined if you use more than 55 gallons a day. It's a target. Kind of like what happens, you know, with the cars. They say we want to have so many gallons per mile by such and such date, and it's sort of a target to get the people who are in control of these things to move towards that target. So that means that your water agency needs to kind of figure out where they can save water. They need to encourage their high water users to use less, and they need to take some certain actions. But, you know, but yes, the legislation that was enacted like 5-6 years ago is still on track to be, like I said, it was a brilliant use of taking two totally unrelated things and putting them together.
Oh, yeah. And just for our listeners, you know, the 55 gallons per person per day, you know, it also has to take into account if there's pets in the home and the size of
right.
the properties and things. And a lot of the water agencies, or most of the water agencies I know, make exceptions to those as long as they know. And you know, one of the biggest things that happened when we had a couple years ago, when we had the big drought, was the fact that children came home from college. So, you know, they're not there for 9 months out of the year. Then all of a sudden they show up in the summertime and the water bill goes up because of showers and everything else. So water agencies were very kind to oblige customers like that and take that. So it's not a hardcore thing where the water police are going to come to your house, you know, stand there and watch you and check your time
no.
in your shower and everything like that. So that's a good thing. I mean, it's realistic.
And this idea, And the idea that if you take a shower and do a load of laundry on the same day, you're going to be over your limit and you're going to get a fine or something. That's not true either.
Yeah. I know different states like Arizona, for example, has the thing where in the summertime they didn't want you to wash clothes between 11 o'clock and 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. And I thought, I understand that because people were using air conditioners and everything else. You know, just trying to balance the system, and if that's appropriate, I don't see anything wrong with that. I know for a lot of businesses, even within Toro, using some of our laboratories with the chambers, our temperature chambers, which use a lot of current, there's different rates for different times of the day. So a lot of testing is done at nighttime when the rates are lower, and you can run it all night long for half the price of running it during the daytime. So that's a good way to balance stuff.
Well,
so
and what's really
energy,
interesting,
water use is just hard to, it's hard even for the agencies, I think, to determine what's fair and what's not fair.
Right.
Well, let me totally on a similar vein, let me tell you the story of the Colorado River in Laughlin. Have you ever been to Laughlin?
Yes.
Nevada?
Yeah.
I mean, we went there and we stayed, and I took up my kids there. The whole family, we went there, and it's fascinating because you go out in the middle of the day, and the water is all full, and it looks great. And then if you go back at the end of the evening or you go out early in the morning, the river is greatly receded. And people who have boats in Laughlin, they have to make sure that they're actually sitting in mud at that point. And the thing is that right above Laughlin is Davis Dam. And Davis Dam is a hydropower dam. And so when everyone in the Southwest flips on their air conditioner, Davis Dam starts putting water down the river. And all the river rises in Laughlin, and it goes all day. Everybody goes out in it. But then in the evening, when you all shut off the air conditioners, Davis Dam shuts off too. And they must ramp it down. They must know there is a time you better have your boat in the dock. But in Laughlin, the river runs with the flip of a switch. I have pictures to prove it. It was really amazing to me, as I didn't realize it at first. But, what's interesting, too, you're talking about power rates and when you use it. That's the whole principle of pump storage hydropower projects. And there is one in Los Angeles County. It runs between Pyramid Lake and Castaic Lake. And there is a hydropower plant in between Pyramid Lake, which is the upper elevation, and Castaic Lake at the lower elevation. And so what they do is in the daytime when people in Los Angeles flip their air conditioners on and they need power, they run water down the pipe from Pyramid Lake into Castaic Lake, and that generates hydropower for everyone's air conditioners. And then at night, when everyone turns them off and power use is down, in the middle of the night, they pump the water back up to Pyramid Lake. They do this all the time. I mean, this is the main purpose of Pyramid Lake. And if you were to be able to go way up to the top of Castaic Lake, there's actually a dam up there that they have to sort of control the water that goes up and down so it doesn't, inadvertently affect Castaic Lake, which there's boaters and fishing and all that stuff going on that probably could use all that, level going up and down. But, it's fascinating. We've come so far. It's, 2021 now, but still electricity is created by the little magnetic wire circling in the field of magnetism that creates the electricity. And with the exception of photovoltaic, the PV solar panels,
right,
it's all about moving the little, you know, piece of wire in the middle of the magnetism field to get the power. So.
Hey, so Chris, can I ask you a question? Because I know it's that, you know, we got 7 or 8 minutes left here to talk, but you know my background, conservation and all that stuff, and I'm a kayaker and I like to get out and all this stuff. I don't know if you can make a comment on this, but can we talk for a minute about the Bayona Wetlands restoration? Is that something we can that you can comment on for a minute?
Yeah, you know, I think it's actually an interesting story. The Bayona Wetlands are this area in between Marina Del Rey and not sure what's on the south side. The bike path kind of goes around it. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife has a plan to do some restoration here. And it seems to be very opposed by a lot of people in the community. Part of the problem, I think, is that, you have to understand natural gas is kind of a hard thing to store. And they tend to store it in natural places where the geology is correct. And there happens to be a way that natural gas is getting stored underneath these wetlands. But it's down low, but it's there. So that probably doesn't help, but there's a plan to work on these wetlands, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, I mean, it probably doesn't seem obvious to people that live down here in Southern California, but there's been a lot of coastal marsh restoration projects that have gone on here in Southern California, and when we first started trying to restore wetlands, we weren't very good at it. And they did a lot of stuff in San Diego, and they sort of learned from where they went wrong, and we've gotten better at it over time. I mean, this is part of what we work on in the Delta and in San Francisco Bay. We're starting to understand how to restore these areas. And the thing about the Bayona Wetlands is when they excavated the area to make the marina at Marina Del Rey, they just kind of dumped it over there. So there's a lot of extra soil. There's, you know, invasive species in terms of plants that really shouldn't be there. And so the Department of Fish and Wildlife has come up with a plan to go in and restore this. And it's an ambitious plan, and it takes a number of years. And at the same time, Southern California Gas is going to go in and going to do some of, you know, fix their infrastructure.
Yeah, pipes and wells and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that's not popular, but I don't know. There's a branch of, like, ecology that sort of has emerged in the past, you know, 5-10 years called reconciliation ecology, which is this idea that, you know, there are going to be human uses and environmental uses, and you just need to find a way to harmonize them. You know, humans are not going to stay out of places. We're all over the place. So, and I think, you know, I would tend to think in this instance on the Bayona Wetlands that you kind of have to take the good with whatever. You need to harmonize that. I mean,
I think, Chris, the argument, as I've, you know, looked into this, is that, okay, so Southern California Gas has got some aged infrastructure in there, and they want to replace wells and pipes and things like that. And, you know, so if they do that, that's great, but it's going to result in, you know, a couple of million cubic feet of, you know, dirt and soil and stuff that's got to go somewhere. And I think the issue is, well, where are they going to put that, right? If they just dump it over the wetlands, right, then all of these species that have been there on in this already fragile area are going to get, you know, are going to get wiped out. So I think what the protagonists are saying is, hey, you know, really this is great and everybody's got this plan 7, 8, 9 years or whatever, but it's really a construction project, not a restoration project.
Yeah, you know, and I will say that the one thing that I think we're starting to learn in the Delta is, you know, there's this idea that, you know, it's nature and just leave it alone and it will fix itself. You know, just breach that levee and walk away from it and it will all be good. And unfortunately, that's not the case, because you have to kind of go back and you have to take care of these things. You know, man has altered so much, at least here in California. You know, we're going to be managing salmon for the rest of, for eternity, because we have changed the environment. We have hatcheries and we have all these things, and we just have to face up to the fact that species management is the way that we're going to have to go forward. You just can't turn your back and say nature will take care of itself, because nature can't. We're taking over nature. So, you know, it's a lot of work. You know, I the thing that I do know, and maybe I don't want to speak to whether they should do this or not in the Biona wetlands, but I do know that there have been some very successful wetlands restoration projects in recent years. There was a lagoon in Malibu that they wanted to go in and work on, and it was highly contested, and they didn't like it. But they went in and they did the work, and 2 years later, everything is much better. And, you know, they had to do some dredging. They had to clear out invasive plants. They did these things, and it improved, although people didn't like it at the time. But, you know, we are getting better at restoration. We've learned a lot.
That
in California.
Right. I mean, I have to believe that there are more success restoration success stories out there, many hundreds, if not several hundred, that I've read myself. Success stories more prevalent than there are, you know, where you hear things that went bad or, you know, went off the track. So any human intervention in a restoration project has yielded. The probability is that they've yielded positive results over negative results by I don't know what the probability is, but by a big factor.
I think in recent years, definitely, because the science community has learned from where they have failed. You know, it doesn't go unnoticed when a whole bunch of money is paid to restore something, and then, you know, you go back 10 years later and it's not done. It's a mess. Right. And people, you know, there were those that said, okay, so why did this fail? And we're getting better at it. We weren't so good 20 years ago. We're much better now. A lot of very successful work being done in the San Francisco Bay Area, which seems to take the most of the media attention, but there's been a lot of work done in Southern California, in Malibu, in the San Diego area, and, you know, even around Santa Monica Bay in some places. And, you know, you like to kayak. Have you ever, I have heard that in the back of Newport Bay, way in the back, there is a wondrous nature preserve there.
It's awesome. I've been back there several times. You know, you got to watch the tide because you get stuck. But it's an awesome place to go, and you can still go there now. You do. Sometimes you need a permit. Sometimes you even need a guide, but you can go back there.
Yeah, I've heard that it's quite spectacular back there. And in the middle of, you know, urban Southern California, there's little gems.
Absolutely is, yep. Prado Dam is another one if you get the opportunity. It's a wonderful place.
certainly need those things to take our mind off of the worries of the world. Chris, we're coming up against our NBC commercial break, and we want to thank you for joining us again and giving us some good insight on what's happening around California. And for our listeners, if you haven't gone to www.maven's notebook, you should do that immediately. You should become a subscriber. If you want to be a sponsor, please do so. You get these wonderful documents every single morning on your computer. It gives you the most up-to-date news of what's happening with your water in California and sometimes across the country. So it's a good thing. So it's www.mavensnotebook.com. Chris, as always, it's a pleasure having you on. We love you having you all the time.
Okay. Take care, guys. And welcome
you too,
back,
Chris. Take care. Have a good week.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with one of our featured guests coming up. And so stick around. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
If you're a landscape contractor, you like the strong things in life. A strong crew, a strong truck, and a strong stomach to handle that strong coffee you drink. Well, you want strong? You've got it. Visit SiteOne Landscape Supply to stock up on professional-grade landscape products during our Save Strong customer event. From August 14th to September 30th, we'll have some of the year's best deals on irrigation, lighting, and turf maintenance products from brands like Hunter, First Editions, FX Luminaire, Lesko, and much more. It's our invitation to help you get ahead for next season. And while you stock up, talk shop with our local experts for product recommendations and specialized services to help your business grow. Don't let SaveStrong pass you by. Stop into SiteOne today for deals on the brands you need to get the job done. Offers valid in-store only August 14th through September 30th, 2017. Restrictions apply. See store for details.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show, and hope everybody's having a good week. And now we bring on our featured guest, and he's got quite a bio, and I was actually put in touch with him by the Global Water Works Association. And I read up about him, and this gentleman is very fascinating. He's got an incredible bio. I could probably read it for the next 30 minutes, and I'm not going to do that, but I think I'd like to hear him tell some of it. His name is Greg Chick. He's an author. He was a contractor. He's a certified landscape irrigation auditor. He's worked with all kinds of things with drip irrigation. He teaches. He owned a big plumbing company, service company. He's retired, but he's really not retired because he's still working on stuff about water and water conservation. So we'd like to bring him on board. So, Greg, welcome to the Water Zone.
Hello, this is Greg. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate you coming on the show. And like I was just saying, I mean, you've done a lot of stuff in your lifetime. And you know, I know you have a sincere passion for water. And kind of want to maybe inform the listeners on what made you get into the water business, and how did you start back in the 70s? And why did you choose this career?
Well, I was probably 15 or something, and I needed a job, so I got this job at this farm supply place in Ojai, Ventura County, and a laborer, and we put in 50 acres of what's called the Ojai Pixie tangerines. And, of course, we had to grade it out, dig the holes, and put in irrigation. So my boss taught me to, you know, do all that stuff, and I got interested in it, and I worked for him for a while. And one day he said, Greg, he says, you need to be your own contractor. Why don't I sign a thing to help you get your license and verify for you? And that's got me into it. And then as an irrigation guy and a landscape guy, I just got obsessed with water and water conservation, and one thing just led to another.
Yeah. And then you went off to Sedona, I believe, and did some design build projects like in the Red Rock.
Yeah. Ojai got kind of, I kind of outgrew Ojai. It's a non-development town still, and it was back then. So I went to Sedona, and I got to design and build what's now the Red Rock State Park, all the piping irrigation and the orchards and whatnot on that. And after I did that, I teamed up with a pool contractor and got my irrigation contractor's license in Arizona. And they did offer one for a short while, called a C-44. They don't offer it anymore. I did that, and then I just got into alternate water and different things, and got a nursery, and just kept going.
So you've done the ag, you've done the irrigation, you taught some classes and stuff for the Irrigation Association, and also for IAMMO. And if people don't, our listeners may not know some of that, but that's the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials. And then you went, I mean, there's a lot of things you did, but then you went off and started your own business in Ramona, California, and they used to call you the Ramona Plumber.
Ramona's Plumber. I jest, because after 30 years, I sold the business to a guy, and I now call myself the plumber formerly known as Ramona's. I did a lot of alternate water, rainwater catchment, and Netafim, a company, a great manufacturer of irrigation, has a special product specifically designed for what we refer to as alternate water, rainwater catchment, gray water, treated gray water, and you know, or water treatment system, wastewater effluent, which might be full of, you know, minerals and stuff. And Netafim has this drip system that they've produced and put out. And I did a couple of systems for one kind of with their materials to do a study on, and then ran rainwater through it. So I kind of jest these days, I hope it rains on your parade.
Do you think the common person, not only in California, but around, I'll say around the country, because there's places in this world that are very sincere and knowledgeable about water, all even down to the consumer level. Do you think the people in California and including the United States really understand the value of water and, you know, what they're getting for what they pay?
Absolutely not. I'm certain many people care, and I'm certain many people have been told more than they want to hear, and I'm very certain that there are countless organizations for profit and not for profit to recommend, or God forbid, mandate water use behavior. But people don't understand really what the worth of water is until they run out, and I forget if it was Benjamin Franklin or who made that famous quote. But the point is that people don't recognize the body of water until they're out. It's something that needs to develop. You know, 100 years ago, architecture built houses with cisterns built inside the structure. If you look at cartoons from the 20s and 30s, all the little shacks that have the little, you know, Mickey Mouse or Flip the Frog or whoever, they'll have downspouts coming from the roof into an oak barrel, a rain barrel. And it was commonplace. It was so common that it was in the cartoons. But World War II came or something, and I think all the cisterns were converted into bomb shelters. I think that's one of the stories. And I think society has just gotten so happy with turn on the faucet, it comes out, period, done. Mm-hmm. And we've got so many other interests to concern ourselves with. I mean, like figuring out a new password for the whatever app you're using is totally mind-boggling and consuming. And so when the water keeps coming out of the faucet, it's hard to stray from that paradigm.
Kind of used to it, aren't we? You know, it kind of trained, if you will.
Very trained. Trained, like kind of like if a dog barks, you feed him, and if the dog barks again, you feed him.
Yeah.
Dogs bark. And they say that's why the dog always barks at the mailman, because every time he comes to the door and he's the mailman the thing, the dog barks, but the mailman runs away. So the dog thinks that he chased the mailman away by barking.
Kind of like the alternative of dog, yeah.
Yeah, my point with water is we're never really without it. I mean, as a plumber for decades, if I had to turn someone's water off to fix a water main, I would say to them, "Oh, well, by the way, Sally and Bob, I'm going to turn your water off." They got this horrified look on their face, like, "Oh, everybody ran," and they would. Can I take a shower first? I got to go flush the toilet. I got to use the toilet. And it became a panic. I mean, like, often. And so I'm like, well, chill. I'm just going to turn your water off for half an hour off the main fix and it's back on. But that was not, you know, workable. So a couple years back, I was shown a survey of the 10 most important things in America. And, you know, the first most important thing was high-speed internet. A flushing toilet was number 7. Now, that's when they're being asked the question in the survey. Just wait till the plumber gets here. He has to turn the water off for 30 minutes. Yeah. It jumps to number 1 right now. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, did you find in today's society that more of the younger people are starting to understand and think about water management versus a little older people, let's say the 55 and above? Because we came from different generations, yeah. Think differently. And I know when I was growing up, they didn't teach a whole lot about water, you know, just the chemical formulations are and things of that sort, but never to what they're doing today. I mean, you know, turning wastewater into drinking water and, you know, the toilet, the tap and all that. People would, they'd freak out when you hear that term.
But yeah, part of the core curriculum. Schools now teach conservation as part of the core curriculum.
Well, yeah. You know, the word conservation, though, has stigmas to it. And, oh, it's all those left coast people in California, you know. They know that the earth is 2/3 water? We got more water than we can deal with. It rains too much, and then they complain we don't have enough and all this. What happens is people get excited about this, that, or the other, but they don't understand the real facts. There's so many, like, what they call armchair, commentators or whatever. And people care, but they don't really have the education to make qualified judgments. So the things that come up to vote on the ballot for water, all the judgments are based on what I would refer to as half-truths, myths. lies, exaggerations, understatements, denials, you name it. But what I would like to see is there's a thing called WET, Water Education for Teachers. California has it. I believe it came out of Sacramento. I believe it still exists. I took the course to use the book that they have, and the book exists. And the book has lessons from the kindergarten level, lessons about water, you know, pouring water into another cup and having it, you know, do something or whatever, all the way up to college level. These experiments and events are adaptable up to the college level. But I went to the San Diego school superintendent, the head superintendent for this county one time years ago, and there were several million dollars earmarked for these courses and stuff, but they had to, you know, be used. And if they weren't going to be used, they went to the general fund. The money went to the general fund. So basically, he did nothing, and he got the millions, put it into his general fund. I call that misappropriated. And the education didn't happen. So what we need is integrated education using water. Not because water is better than air, because you only live 4 minutes, or what is it, 4 minutes without air? Yeah. And hell, you could live 2 or 3 days without water. So, but it's right next to air, you know, and it's just misunderstood. I would hope a better educational system goes in about water, but not just about water conservation, about water itself. It's very underrepresented.
Right.
People represent the water district. They represent the state in the water. They represent their bottled water. They represent the water company that makes water treatment systems. But nobody represents water as a substance. And I think water needs a representative. That's kind of why I call myself an
advocate.
Proclaimed a water evangelist.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff, Greg, that we've talked about, in the last 10, 15 minutes or so, came from the book that you have called All About Water. And by the way, I've had the opportunity over several years to see it referenced and looked at it. It's a great book. I think it's in the second edition, Greg, or do you have a third already or working on it?
No, it is. Thank you. I forgot all about that wonderful book. You know, I just wanted the people understand more about water. So I wrote the book, you know, All About Water, as told by the plumber. And it's only 100 pages. It's full of a bunch of cute little art. And it's got chapters that break it down into neat little bite-sized things. And there's some cute quips in it. And there's a little humor in it. But it isn't selling off the shelf. I think it's probably because people are dealing with more urgent things because they turn on the faucet and the water comes out. I'm not sure, but I sure wish more people, or even water districts, would use that book. It's cheap enough as a public information.
Why don't you tell our listeners where they can see a copy?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. I love it. Amazon, you can buy it on Amazon. It's sold in I think, 4 different e-versions, you know, Kindle, whatnot. And I can't just, like, email everybody a link to it, but Amazon, the book is called All About Water, as told by the plumber. And then there's this little comma, who's seen it all. But the book, I believe it's $5 or less. Online, and I know for sure it's on Amazon and at Goodreads.
Yeah.
That's a book reading site.
Go ahead, Chris.
I can be a small advocate for you because, you know, I have seen it, especially over the last couple of years as I've done training at different water agencies and things like that. So I've made reference from it. I mean, I like the characters in there. Mac and Mike, Micro, So if you, you know,
yes, thank you. I was trying
you
to
tell,
add
yeah,
a
tell
little,
us tell us
humor.
Tell us about tell us about how you picked those names.
Well, actually, I was going to write a book about this a different direction. I was going to completely write it in a different direction. I worked on it for about a year. I'm not a writer, so I hired an editor to help me. And one day after a year, I went to her and I said, Marta, I said, I got a whole new idea. We can't do that. We got to make this fun. And I saw this book down at the little bookstore. It was called What Is My Pea Telling Me? It was a little yellow book. And I picked it up because, you know, I thought it was funny. And I opened it up, and I could not put it down until I read the whole damn book. Of course, it was a cheesy little book like mine and easy to read quickly. And it had a lot of pictures. And it was humor. What is my pea telling me? So it changed me to say, I need something that's going to be fun. So I came up with Mike and Mac. Their last name is Roe. One sees it micro, one sees it macro. And I kind of play off of the polarities of you know, those who say yay and those who say nay, or tomato, tomato, or whatever. And I think I achieved creating people in the book that the reader might identify with. They might identify with Mac or Mike or Goldie, which is Mike's girlfriend, or Jane, which is Mac's wife.
Goldie's high maintenance.
Goldie, she's the one in the tub with the cucumber slices on her eyes. if you see the artwork, you know, it's quite funny. And incidentally, my wife is named Jane, so I must be Mac.
Yeah, it's a great book. It is a quick and easy read, very entertaining, but it's packed with information, and you deliver it in such a way that even if it's a quick read, Greg, it's still great. You talk about, you know, the gray water stuff that we just talked about. You talk about choosing the right landscape, and really it's all about how we use the water, and there's some meat in it too, Greg. You got, you know,
I think I chose all the subjects that people may or may not know of, or may have been told too much about, but don't understand or don't want to know. And here it is in one little paragraph. And it's not really my opinion. I've got all my references from the American Rainwater Catchment Association to the, you know, all the other acronyms. I'll spare the audience. But it's all reference material there. And the links are there in the book in the back.
Tons of resources as well, and links and places you can go. You even mentioned the Flint water crisis in there. We've had the mayor of Flint, Michigan, on our show.
Oh, yes. Oh, wonderful. Yeah, Flint. Wow. You know, a lot of people don't understand what happened. It was the biofilm that got everybody. And people need to understand what biofilm is. There's biofilm in everyone's water main. Right now, as we speak, if every listener went out and turned off their water, drained down all the water pressure in their pipes, instantly turned that water back on, full force, real quick, that water velocity would stir up all the biofilm, and the water that came out of their faucets would either plug up their aerators or conceivably pollute them in some way. And so there's behaviors needed in how to shut water down and how to start it up and how you can treat your own, and everything. I think if everybody reads that book, I think they could pick one little section in it and say, oh, my God, I'm going to do that, and benefit from it.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Well since I got a copy that you had kindly forwarded to me, digital version, I started reading it this morning, and I you probably heard me chuckle out loud, because there's some funny parts in there. I like how you described the DIY. You know, it's either do it yourself or damage it yourself.
Right. True.
And I always tell everybody, I'm to the age where I do everything HID, hire it done, because I don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
But, you know, how you came up with those names and the chapters is very well organized, and you know, all the excuses that you've heard, of, you know, what's wrong and why they did something, and some of the things like, you know, there's a drip under the sink in the kitchen that just won't stop, and Max says the drip might be symptom of something bigger. Did the hardware guy make sure you knew that's a possibility? So you present it in such a simplest way that everybody can get what you're saying, and it's a very easy read. I mean, it's very well done, and I applaud you for that. And I think a lot of water agencies should pick up on that book and do some things with that. I really think
they could. And as a matter of fact, I've offered water districts to customize the printing of the book if they'll order mm-hmm. so many. To say, okay, how many do you want? I'll reference your district or reference applicable things that are more specifically that water district's liability or need or virtue or whatever. It's easily done in today's world of digital printing and whatnot. Be glad to do that.
Well,
you know, I got what I got from my customers. I should say customers, my viewers, of my 21-something million views on my DIY site.
Yeah, that's what I was going to talk about next. And you still teach.
Yes.
Correct? Can you give us a little bit about your website and things so people can go look at that?
Well, you know, the Internet is like a slippery slope in the snow down a steep slope. you start at the top and you end up at the bottom, and how you got there is really crazy. But if you search out DIY, plumbingadvice.com, and actually get to DIYplumbingadvice.com, not the things that Google thinks you really wanted instead, and all the ads, you get to my site, there's one could spend probably 8 hours watching the 50-something videos, and it's all free, you know, there's literally 21 million views and I think 21,000 followers, and I think I got tens of thousands of comments, and everybody that's asked me a question on that site, everybody, I have emailed back. I've called some of them back. I've given them my phone number and had them call me at their convenience. I've answered the phone, and I've spent time with them solving their water/plumbing issue all for free. There's a tip jar on the site, you know, if somebody wants to throw me a bone. But, it's a PayPal tip jar. And I get some money there. And there's some annoying ads that Google puts on it. I can't do anything about that. I can't control it. If it's on YouTube, it's got ads. But there's a lot there to be learned. DIYplumbingadvice.com.
Wow. Well, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was just going to say, all right, we're coming up against the news hour there, Rob, if you're checking out the time. About 57 seconds left.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you 57 hours of this. But I can't. So I thank you guys for helping, the public know about water. And anytime, just let me know. I'll be glad to spread more of my name.
We'll definitely want to contact you for some more stuff, and even talk about your book. I mentioned to you on our phone call earlier that about the things that we're doing, and I want to touch base with you on that in the next couple of days. So, Greg, we certainly appreciate you coming on. I hope you're staying safe from COVID, and we wish you the best of luck on your unretirement.
Thank you, guys, and I love your show. It's passionate,
great.
And it's real.
Great. Thanks a lot. And everybody, just so you know, we're going to be back next week, and we're glad Chris returned from, as I said, from the grasp of the COVID, and we're now back to normal, except we're still not in the studio yet. We're still doing all our shows remotely from different places.